I'm doing something slightly unusual at the end of this course. Most courses that endeavor to survey the whole of Shakespeare end with The Tempest. I'm going on one play further. I want to talk about Henry VIII, which Shakespeare certainly wrote after The Tempest. Henry VIII gets left out sometimes because people believe that Shakespeare was not the sole author. They believe that John Fletcher collaborated in the writing of it. There is no external evidence supporting that view, and I think that the play was all of Shakespeare's. But I'm not going to spend time on an authorship issue. If you are interested in following that up, I have provided materials in the bibliography. The real reason why people leave this out of a course is that Henry VIII is a kind of sport in the chronology of Shakespeare's career. It comes at the end, after The Tempest, and The Winter's Tale, and Cymbeline, and Pericles. And yet its plot does not draw upon the sort of romance material that provides the stories for those four plays. It handles English history instead. And yet it does not line up easily with Shakespeare's other plays on English history. Unlike the rest of Shakespeare's English kings, Henry VIII is not engaged in either civil or foreign war. And the portrait of Henry is not nearly as searching, psychologically, as Shakespeare's portrait of Richard II or Richard III or Henry IV and Henry V. It was, moreover, written 13 or 14 years after Shakespeare had finished the rest of his English history plays. The last of them is Henry V, written in 1599, and this play was probably written in 1613. There's another way in which the play is odd. It provides a surprise in its content. Henry VIII does not contain what the ordinary reader expects to find in a play about the second Tudor King of England. With most of his history plays, Shakespeare himself has been extraordinarily influential in creating the idea that later generations have held of the salient characteristics of medieval English history. Although modern specialists in English medieval history will point out that Shakespeare is mistaken on some points, or simply imaginative here and there, rearranging things, his cycle of plays on the late Plantagenet kings, the eight plays from Richard II through Henry IV and V and VI to Richard III, still stands as the liveliest and most widely known version of 15th century English history. It is he who has etched upon the common memory the graceful fecklessness of Richard II, the exuberant heroism of Henry V, and the dazzling villainy of Richard III. Back in the 18th century, the great Duke of Marlborough said, "Shakespeare is all the English history I know." And if he'd been Keats, he would have added, "and all I need to know." That's what he meant. But with Henry VIII, Shakespeare has had no lasting influence on the common conception of the king. If you know anything about Henry VIII at all, you know that he married six wives and brought about the English Reformation. I was taught a little rhyme about him when I was still a kid. Henry VIII, six wives wedded, one died, one survived, two divorced, two beheaded. That's how you remembered them. The hectic marital career made Henry something of a cult fertility figure. There's a suit of armor at the Tower of London made for Henry, designed for Henry in his latter years. It has a notably ostentatious codpiece. Tourists are fond of touching that codpiece as they go past. That's why it looks shinier than the rest of the suit. It's a sort of fertility totem. Although, in fact, Henry VIII had a problem about fertility. He had a lot of wives. He didn't have that many children. That was why he had so many wives, that he kept trying to have legitimate children. Henry is also remembered as a tyrant, the king who destroyed the English monasteries and wasted the money that he gained from their dissolution, the king who executed two of his wives, who struck down saints like Thomas More and Bishop Fisher, and statesmen like Cardinal Wolsey and Thomas Cromwell. This is the king who was summed up by Charles Dickens as a most intolerable ruffian, a disgrace to human nature, and a blot of blood and grease upon the history of England. Now that's the Henry we really know, the Henry of Holbein's portraits, which were done late in Henry's career, in his late 40s and early 50s. He didn't live to be more than 55. By that time, Henry, who had started out as a splendid young athlete, handsome, strong, with that marvelous red-gold Plantagenet hair that he inherited from his mother, by that time, he had turned into a gross and diseased hulk with piggy little eyes. This is the Henry that we know from television series and from historical romances, and particularly for the 20th century, I think the greatest influence was Charles Laughton. The actor Charles Laughton did a film called The Six Wives of Henry VIII in the 1930s. And in that film, he grossly ate some chicken and then threw the bone over his shoulder. That is probably the moment that the image of Henry VIII clicked for the 20th century. What many people remember, that's what Henry VIII is like. That Henry that I have been describing, this gross and cruel man, is not in Shakespeare's play. Shakespeare's play deals with only the first two wives and does not mention that the second of those two, Anne Boleyn, eventually had her head chopped off. Shakespeare's play deals extremely tactfully with the Reformation, and it ends with Henry still in his prime at the age of 42, before the deaths of More and Fisher and Cromwell, and generally presents the king as an embodiment of benevolence and dignified majesty. Now, I don't mean to suggest that people of Shakespeare's time were ignorant of Henry's more appalling acts. Sir Walter Raleigh thought Henry was a tyrant. Indeed, he said so in print. Walter Raleigh wrote A History of the World, a huge volume, and in the preface he remarked that if all the pictures and patterns of a merciless prince were lost to the world, they might all again be painted to the life out of the story of this king. But Walter Raleigh wrote this in the Tower. He was imprisoned there by King James I, writing the history of the world as the way he passed his time. And King James had some rather sharp things to say about what Raleigh had said about kings in his book when it got published. Shakespeare's relation to King James I was quite different. James I was the patron of his theatrical company. When Elizabeth died, his company, which had been the Lord Chamberlain's men, was the leading company in London, and therefore it got the patronage of the new monarch, who was James I. And occasionally, there are allusions in Shakespeare's plays to the activities of James. Macbeth concerns James I's Scottish ancestry. He was descended supposedly from Banquo. Measure for Measure may contain some allusions to James I in the handling of the Duke. Shakespeare was writing as the house dramatist for an acting company in which James took a particular interest. Now, he was honest enough, Shakespeare was, to include some of the dreadful things in The Ring. Three distinguished people fall from high place. The Duke of Buckingham, charged with treason, on plotting the death of the king, or imagining the death of the king and hoping to be his heir. Catherine of Aragon, Henry's first queen, who gets divorced and set aside. And Cardinal Wolsey. They do fall. Shakespeare even hints at some atrocities that were to occur later in the reign. In the final dialogue between Wolsey and Thomas Cromwell in the third act, we have significant references to the present activities of Sir Thomas More and Archbishop of Cranmer and Queen Anne Boleyn. It is a doomed trio. All three of those will die by royal order before the natural term of their lives is over. But you have to know that. Shakespeare doesn't provide you with the information. If you happen to be quite well informed, you can pick it up. And later in that same scene, Wolsey kind of half prophesies to Cromwell that Cromwell himself will fall. Henry VIII is not an easy master to please or to keep pleased. But except for that half prophecy, these things are not explicit. Shakespeare's focus is on the good things that Tudor history brought to England, chiefly the English Church, the Anglican Church, and Elizabeth herself, Henry's second daughter. Now, it is not fashionable anymore to regard history in this Whiggish way, to see the 16th century as a triumphant progress toward good things. It may be romantic to regard it in that way. But I think it's equally one-sided to regard history as nothing but a series of chopping blocks as well. It was possible in 1613, when Shakespeare wrote the play, to regard Tudor history as a triumphant progress. And his source, Shakespeare's source, Holinshed, certainly had done so. He entitles his chapter on Henry, The Triumphant Reign of Henry VIII. There is only one thing that I will object to as really deeply unhistorical in this play, and that is the play closes with the birth and christening of the infant Elizabeth, who is to become queen of famous memory in her own turn, and rule England so successfully for a period of 45 years. And Archbishop Cranmer predicts, has a prophetic vision of the great success of her reign. So Henry concludes that the most important thing that he did in his reign was to beget Elizabeth. Henry did nothing of the kind. Henry's marriages and divorces were in search of a male heir. And when he'd finally divorced Catherine of Aragon and gotten rid of her and married Anne Boleyn and got her pregnant, he was deeply disappointed that the child turned out to be female. And he had to start all over again. Nonetheless, in 1613, I was saying, it was possible to entertain a very favorable view of the achievements of Henry's reign. It was particularly possible in, or likely, in that year. For in 1613, there was a royal festivity of great importance to Protestant England. James I of England was, of course, the leading Protestant monarch in all Europe. In the year 1613, his daughter married Prince Friedrich, the Elector Palatine, who was the leader of the German Protestant League. The alliance was a major diplomatic occasion and was celebrated with extended magnificence and occasioned considerable Protestant panegyric on the happy couple and their prospects for Europe in general. Now, since James's daughter, who married the Elector Palatine, was also called Elizabeth, her marriage recalled to memory the achievements of Queen Elizabeth, who had been dead for only 10 years at that point. And some people saw the princess as following Queen Elizabeth I in her support of the true religion. A play about the downfall of Wolsey, who was the last great Catholic statesman in England, and the rise of Cranmer, the first great Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury, and the rise of the English Church along with him, ending with the birth of Queen Elizabeth and prophecies of the glories of her reign, was very appropriate in the year 1613. The play is obviously ceremonial, celebratory. And indeed, it has a very distinguished history in the theater as a celebratory piece. It has been produced often on the occasions of real royal celebration in connection with the coronation of subsequent monarchs, a custom that began early in the 18th century and goes on to Her Present Majesty. There was a magnificent production of the play at Stratford in 1953 to mark the coronation of Elizabeth II. And these productions have been notable for lavishness. In 1762, at Drury Lane, in connection with celebrations of the reign of George III, 130 extras appeared in the coronation procession of Anne Boleyn in a production of this play. In 1892, late Victorian times, Sir Henry Irving produced the play and created what he called a genuine reproduction of old London to occupy the whole of the stage, as well as an even more splendid reproduction of the Church of the Grey Friars in Greenwich for the scene of the christening of Elizabeth. These productions have also been noticeable for historical authenticity of detail. As early as the late 17th century, they were using authentic Tudor costumes for productions of Henry VIII. That was before, considerably before, other Shakespeare plays were properly dressed in period that way. I mean, at this time, they were still playing English kings in costumes of the player's own time, so that Henry IV might turn up in a red coat as if he were an 18th century English general and king rather than a 15th century one. But they thought it was important for Henry the Eighth to get it right, to get it accurate. And the play has been important for more than celebratory things. Actors have liked to play these roles, particularly the roles of the three people who fall in the course of the play. Buckingham and Catherine of Aragon and Wolsey are the most marvelous roles. They have been more important than the lead role, Henry himself, which has been less popular with performers. Now, this stage history that I am sketching isolates an obvious peculiarity of the play, a feature which also differentiates it from Shakespeare's earlier plays on English history. Nowhere else in Shakespeare is there so much spectacle as there is in this play. Stage scenes are organized around processions whose elaboration is specified in the stage direction. Let me give you an example. This is the scene where a trial is held on the validity of Henry's marriage to his first queen, Catherine. And I will read you the whole stage direction. Trumpets, senet, and cornets, that's three kinds of brass instruments, are to sound. Enter two vergers, those are people who lead processions in the Church of England, with short silver wands. Next them, two scribes in the habit of doctors. After them, the Archbishop of Canterbury alone. After him, the bishops of Lincoln, Ely, Rochester, and St. Asaph. Next them, with some small distance, follows a gentleman bearing the purse with the great seal and a cardinal's hat. Then two priests, each bearing a silver cross. Then a gentleman usher, bareheaded, accompanied by a sergeant of arms bearing a silver mace. Then two gentlemen bearing two great silver pillars. After them, side by side, the two cardinals, Wolsey and Campeus. Two noblemen with the sword and the mace. The king takes place under the cloth of state. The two cardinals sit under him as judges. The queen takes place at some distance from the king. The bishops place themselves on each side the court in a manner of consistory. Below them, the scribes. The lords sit next to the bishops. The rest of the attendants stand in convenient order about the stage. That is a Shakespearean stage direction. This from the man who generally writes, enter so-and-so, they fight, he dies, and sometimes leaves out that part. He is specifying what he wants, and it is very elaborate and very detailed. There is not only this trial on Catherine's marriage, there is a great banquet accompanied by a mask, which is a form of visual and dancing entertainment, at Cardinal Wolsey's house. Buckingham, when he is condemned to death, has a procession away from the trial to take him to the Tower, a procession marked with black halberds and axes turned toward Buckingham's head, which was the customary way to take a highly placed person convicted of treason. Anne Boleyn, the second queen, is crowned. There is a vast coronation procession for that. Catherine of Aragon, the first queen, thereafter has a deathbed scene during which she has a vision of angels who are crowning her with a heavenly crown. And there is the christening of Elizabeth at the end. And a good many more ceremonial entrances, which I won't take time to detail now. And even if you don't mount such things with 130 extras or a reproduction of old London, you must reckon in analyzing this play that a great deal of stage time is taken up with the public rituals of power and glory. And further time is devoted to the description of glory. In the opening scene, the Duke of Norfolk describes, verbally, a great diplomatic occasion, the Field of the Cloth of Gold, where Henry VIII went to northern France and met François Premier and had a great diplomatic conference with him, accompanied with joustings and masks and other sorts of entertainments of the kind that happen when royalty meet each other. The values important in the play are carried by spectacle to a far greater degree than is normal in drama. Drama has turned halfway into a mask form. This kind of spectacle that was put on at court, particularly favored by King James I. To understand the play, you must spend at least a little time investigating these spectacular values, as suggested by the careful directions for props and costumes. It isn't, by the way, just one big scene after another. They are carefully differentiated. The point, for example, about that great diplomatic occasion, the Field of the Cloth of Gold, is that it's fake. It's a false vision of peace. That, I think, is why it's described verbally. Norfolk talks about there being too much gilt. Everybody is being highly competitive in how they dress. The madams sweat to bear their pride upon them. They're so heavily dressed that they just perspire right through their garments. That's why it's described. It's got to seem splendid at first and then prove to be false. As a matter of fact, we are told Wolsey arranged this for his own purposes. The peace treaty that was signed at the Field of the Cloth of Gold was immediately broken. It had no effect on English history. In fact, it was a great waste of money. Now, you couldn't make that point so well if you staged it. If you staged it, it would just look magnificent. But if you talk about it, if you get verbal description, then Norfolk can make it sound good at first and then verbally undercut it as he goes along. The ceremony accompanying Buckingham from trial to execution is, of course, a tragic ceremony. The important props I've mentioned, the halberds and the axes. These symbols of death are the more remarkable for their contrast with the previous scene, which was the scene of at the banquet at Wolsey's house, the banquet where Henry met Anne Boleyn for the first time. That had fair ladies and music and crowds of shepherds. There was merriment, there was vitality, there was fertility. The ceremony of the doom of Buckingham follows, so that we have both the fertility and the possibility of love there, followed by the death as competing spectacles. The ceremony of the trial, whose stage direction I have read to you, is very lavish. It is an ecclesiastical trial, of course. That's why all those bishops and cardinals are the judges, and there are crosses and so forth. Catholic England before the Reformation, matters of marriage, as well as other matters touching on the sacraments, were settled by ecclesiastical courts, not by secular courts. The bishops and the archbishop and the cardinals are very prominent in the display, but most of them, in fact, are extras from the point of view of drama. Most of them say nothing. Wolsey talks a lot and the king talks a lot, but they're just there for the spectacle. However, they are ecclesiastics, and cardinals wear red, and bishops wear spectacular costumes as well, so you are getting the full massed power of the Church of Rome. Now, the first half of this scene, when it actually gets into dialogue, when we've got through processing around, is Catherine's scene. All the weight of this legal ecclesiastical power is brought to bear on one lone woman, a foreigner, a Spaniard, who has no advice, no friends of her own in this country. And Henry is trying to end his marriage with her. But it is not only Catherine's scene. She makes a magnificent plea for herself, and then with great dignity appeals the case directly to the Pope and says she will have nothing to do more with this court and goes out. The rest of the scene is Henry's. And in a 53-line speech, the longest speech of the play, Henry finally declares what the origins of his doubts about the marriage were, a matter that's been much speculated about but never firmly explained. And here we see the weight of ceremony, the weight of responsibility resting on the king. The problem for the king is that he has no male heir, and you have to have a male heir if you're going to continue a monarchy, or so he thinks. And although he is not isolated in the way that Catherine was, all this legal and ecclesiastical panoply is no help to him. Wolsey has ceased to be helpful. Cardinal Campeus wants to adjourn the trial. The maneuverings of all these splendid officials have become for Henry what he calls the dilatory sloth and tricks of Rome. A new order is necessary, headed by a different kind of ecclesiastic, a person that Henry calls my learned and well-beloved servant, Cranmer. Cranmer, who will become the new Archbishop of Canterbury and found the Church of England. The scarlet of cardinals does not help to solve problems. Learning and fidelity in Thomas Cranmer may. The next two ceremonies also turn up as a paired contrast: Anne's coronation and Catherine's deathbed vision of heaven. One of the small miracles of Shakespeare's play is that he manages to treat favorably both of Henry's first two queens. Most treatments of this period feel obliged to support one at the expense of the other. But Shakespeare contrives to make both of them sympathetic. Catherine is warm and majestic and dignified, a very distinguished person indeed. Anne is charming and fresh and modest and young. Each here in Act IV receives a ceremonial triumph, and the triumphs are sharply different in kind. Anne's coronation is an image of earthly glory. There are trumpets and symbols of worldly power, dukes and duchesses, elaborate crowns, and there is verbal description of a great deal of noise, commotion, and jokes. And there is stress in the description on fertility, on sexuality. Anne Boleyn was pregnant when she was crowned queen. She was already pregnant with Elizabeth. This is, after all, a very important fetus she is carrying. And she must be visibly pregnant as she walks through the street to her coronation. It is therefore appropriate that one of the describing gentlemen should talk about the enthusiasm of other pregnant women in the street who are watching the procession go by. In fact, they want to get into the matter in a way that is so overstated as to be almost grotesque. He says, "Great bellied women that had not half a week to go, like rams in the old time of war, would shake the press and make them reel before him." And other pregnant women who are very close to term, not half a week to go, are using their pregnancies like battering rams to get through the crowd and see the pregnant queen. It's a marvelous image. We will triumph through peace and fertility, not through war and battering rams. We will win with pregnancies. Catherine's vision, on the other hand, is heavenly, not earthly. And it is serious. It is quiet, and it is utterly simple. It occurs while the principal figure is in a trance. And the extras, instead of being lords and ladies who are dressed and jeweled to the teeth, are six angels clad in plain white robes. and the crown that is offered to Catherine is described as a plain garland. In heaven, all you need is a simple crown. You don't need an elaborate, jeweled, earthly crown. The triumph of patience and fortitude, which she has displayed, is pure and plain and solemn. Now, the extraordinary emphasis on ceremony carries with it another peculiarity of the structure, the dramaturgy of the play. An unusual quantity of the play is devoted to people describing what's going on. Anonymous or semi-anonymous persons who are just gossiping about the latest news or telling us about a procession we haven't seen. Theater people call these characters walking gentlemen because the character really has no character at all. He just appears as a nicely dressed gentleman strolling down the street with his friend saying, did you hear about this and that? Did you hear about the other? In order to get the exposition off to across to the audience. These walking gentlemen turn up all the time. And in fact, even some of the highly placed lords, the Duke of Norfolk and Suffolk and so forth, they are simply superior walking gentlemen. They have more personal attitudes toward the principal characters, and occasionally they speak to the principals, but they have no real effect on events, although their historical originals may have done so. They merely lurk in the corridors of power, registering events. They are not politicians. They are more like modern reporters saying, have you heard, and this is what has happened, and so forth and so on, having no influence. They are witnesses of history, not makers of it. Now, a dramatic structure that is composed of these elements, composed of ceremonies presenting the current state of affairs, interspersed with reports and rumors of what else is going on, provokes a particular question. Where is the action? The kind of question I've been asking all through this course. What makes things happen and when? Who produces the history? Henry VIII is a play that avoids putting many of the crucial transactions on stage. If this were like the early history plays, we would see plots being hatched, we would see the king meditating alternatives, we would see history in process. Not the product of history in the form of procession or report. Well, where does history come from? Early in the play, the prime mover is Cardinal Wolsey. He arranged the field of the cloth of gold. He presses the case against Buckingham. He organizes the divorce trial. His dominance is reported to us. And his position is emblematized when the king enters leaning on Wolsey. Wolsey is the faithful minister of the crown. But we do not actually see him plotting or planning until an extended scene in the middle of the play when he falls, when the king withdraws his favor. In fact, we know already that the king is going to do it. We've been informed by those walking gentlemen that the king has turned against Wolsey. As a result, the exact rights and wrongs of the case against Buckingham never get absolutely clear. We know that Wolsey was his enemy, but Buckingham was condemned by the House of Lords, and that's a legal procedure. So maybe he was guilty. We're not sure. As a more important result, the origins of the royal divorce are murky. Wolsey carries the blame. Catherine considers Wolsey clearly to be her enemy. And she's a sympathetic person, so we feel him to be villainous. But after the king takes over the trial scene, we discover that Wolsey had nothing to do with precipitating the doubt about the legality of that marriage, and certainly wasn't in favor of elevating Anne Boleyn to the position of queen. Now, I'm not trying to make a mystery out of this. We do know who does most of the important things. Cardinal Wolsey rules, for the most part, until the trial scene in the middle of the play. After that, the king takes over. you could fairly describe the overall change during the play as first the king reigns, but afterwards he really rules. First the king delegates, but then he takes charge. Having left things to a deputy who is driven by his own personal ambitions, he discovers the untrustworthiness of that deputy and asserts himself. The king becomes the mighty Henry VIII of famous memory. He upholds the English church in the person of Archbishop Cranmer, and he begets the great English queen in the person of Elizabeth. This is plain. But this is not directly presented to us as a political story. Only at one moment in the play do we really enter into the king's mind. And that's the moment at the end of the trial scene that I've already described, when he talks about the sloth and dilatory tricks of Rome, and I must send for Cranmer, I must tackle this thing in an entirely new way. Otherwise, Henry remains a fairly remote figure of majesty and authority, a figure who looks down from the upper stage, rather like Prospero looking down on Ferdinand and Miranda, or on King Alonso and Antonio and Sebastian, who are within the circle of his power. Buckingham and Wolsey and Catherine are far more developed than Henry as individual persons. We get much more interested in their emotions. It is no wonder that they are favorite actors' roles and the king is not. But they are developed most when they've lost power. It's very interesting in this play how character can be displayed when it detaches itself from the ability to influence history any longer. We see Buckingham on his way to the chopping block. We see Catherine as she is discarded, trying to endure her trials with fortitude and patience. We see Wolsey most fully in the scene of his fall, where he ceases to be so villainous and becomes a sympathetic figure, realizing what mistakes he has made. He becomes a tragic figure who has made mistakes, sees it, and wishes that he had served his God, served my God, but half as well as I have served my king. They are interesting, these three, in their growth of resignation, acceptance, patience, insight. They develop a kind of exalted steadfastness, a spiritual richness in adversity. That's the way they're interesting, not in their influence on history, their effect on the plot. Now, here I want to make an important distinction. One of the remarkable achievements of Shakespeare's early histories was the combination of the personal and the political. The Richards and the Hals and the Falstaffs are fully developed as individuals, and yet the nature and fate of England is simultaneously developed and explored. Henry IV is interesting as a man and as a king. This double valence, the equal validity of the personal and the public, continues in the major tragedies. Hamlet does justice to both the rottenness of Denmark and a remarkable man in the lead role. Now, Henry VIII is concerned with individuals and with public events, but the two concerns are split. Catherine, the fallen Wolsey, and Buckingham are interesting when their lives split off from history, when they no longer have any role in great events and simply must adjust to that fact. They no longer create things. The history is actually made by a king who is kept remote and majestic, whose psychology is largely undramatized. The history is made by God's deputy. As a history play, Henry VIII is providential history, the story of a chosen people in a major transition from the Roman obedience to Protestant independence. A transition in which the monarch protects the church and the Archbishop of Canterbury kneels to and is saved by the king. Such providentialism is, of course, not entirely absent from the Plantagenet histories. All English history plays at least suggest that God is in control at some level or another of the events. God directs human history. But in the Plantagenet plays, as I discussed them earlier in this course, I made the point that God may be acknowledged here and there, but what Shakespeare is interested in is what the human beings do. And he explores them deeply, their motives, their efforts. The earlier history plays enact a political drama that may take place under God's eyes, but we're interested in the political drama. Henry VIII enacts a metaphysical drama. In fact, it's the men who are watching, men's eyes. Those walking gentlemen see Henry as a sort of deputy of God, somehow mysteriously make things come out right in England. Thus, the peculiar dramaturgy, the combination of ceremony that is bridged together by the gossip passages of the walking gentleman. For us in the audience, this is a pageant, a series of ceremonies. For the walking gentlemen and lords, it is a mysterious unfolding of events in which they are deeply interested, but over which they do not have very much control. For the dominant characters at their fullest, and I mean Wolsey and Catherine and Buckingham, it is a struggle to reconcile themselves to the will of God. And the king himself is the earthly embodiment of God, almost identified with him, and therefore not very accessible to us. Early in the play, a lord who is arrested on a charge of treason meekly responds, "The will of heaven be done, and the king's pleasure by me obeyed." As if those two things, the will of heaven and the king's pleasure, were the same thing. In the last act, the king is talking to a friend at a window above an action where the Archbishop of Canterbury is being challenged by some nasty people. And he's going to protect the Archbishop of Canterbury. And he utters the line, "'Tis well, there's one above them yet." Is that one got a capital O on it? Or is it Henry? Does it make any difference? In other words, Henry VIII depicts history in the mode of romance. It takes the facts of English history and then uses the form that Shakespeare had been developing through The Tempest and The Winter's Tale. The Winter's Tale and The Tempest and Cymbeline dramatize a regenerative process. Jealousy and crime and family separation, the disorders symbolized by storm and shipwreck, are healed eventually by time, music, magic, forgiveness, and the intervention of benevolent gods. In Henry VIII, this regenerative process occurs again. But instead of the romantic tale of a separated family, we have the redemption of a particular kingdom. The gods, who are referred to in Cymbeline, become definitely the Christian god. Classical illusions to Apollo and Jupiter become prayers and quotations from Scripture. The whole action celebrates the English achievement of a very particular politico-religious arrangement that was arrived at in the 16th century in England. Now, to write such a play is, I suppose, a parochial act, even a chauvinist one. Obviously, this play doesn't exert the wide human appeal that Henry IV does, and I would never argue that it's a better play than Henry IV. But it does say something important about Shakespeare. I started my interpretation of this play by investigating details of dramaturgy, the particular kinds of scenes and structure he devises to tell this story in this way. Throughout his career, Shakespeare experimented with dramaturgy, blending and mixing modes and genres. Histories that are tragic, like Richard II, histories that are comic, like Henry IV, Part I, tragedies with fools in them, comedies with tragic figures that burst out of the frame, like Shylock. In this play, he constructs a remarkable mixture of genres. History about the founding of the English Church and the birth of Elizabeth, but also tragedy in the fall of Buckingham and Wolsey and Catherine, and also comedy in the marriage and happiness of Henry and Anne together. He recasts all these things into a new form. In this play, Shakespeare's imaginative combination of genres and modes of writing provide us with a dramatic experience and a vision of reality that the earlier histories could not have accommodated. In his 37th play, as with his 10th play and his 20th, Shakespeare remains the restless experimenter with dramatic form. He was always adjusting his dramatic lens, that extraordinarily fine focus, always adjusting it to capture yet another aspect of human experience, another way to see the passing show around us.
The lecturer is Professor Peter Sacho. Professor Sacho is an award-winning professor and accomplished writer, actor, and theatrical director. He received his PhD from Princeton and began his teaching career at Dartmouth College in 1966, where he continues to teach today. He has also served as a visiting professor at Wesleyan University and at University College in London. Professor Sacho has an extensive writing career. He has published or delivered at conferences more than 20 papers on Shakespeare and other dramatists. He is the author of two books, including Shakespeare's English Kings, which was released in 1977 and has become a classic in its field. He is also the editor of Thomas Middleton's comedy, A Mad World, My Masters, for the Oxford Complete Works of Thomas Middleton. In addition to his writing and public speaking career, Professor Sacho is also an accomplished director and actor. He has directed productions of Twelfth Night, Macbeth, and Cymbeline, and has devised and directed programs of scenes from Shakespeare and from modern British drama. His acting credits include the Shakespearean roles of Casca, Angelo, Bassanio, and Henry IV, as well as various parts in the ancient and modern plays. His teaching awards include Dartmouth's J. Kenneth Huntington Memorial Award for Outstanding Teaching. Each of Professor Sacho's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, and bibliography. You may find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Photographs of onstage productions for this series were provided in part by the Shakespeare Theater in Washington, D.C.